Voyage.
When we left Jason last time, she was in court waiting to hear the verdict after the trial of her assailant, Refugio.
The judge asked if they had reached a verdict. And the foreman stood and said, "Yes, Your Honor, we have." And so he passed it over to the judge, and the judge said, "Please read your verdict for count one, kidnapping, guilty. Count two, rape. Enhanced, guilty." Every charge they had against him, the jury found him to be guilty. There was one charge that was not charged that I felt like it should have been, and that was attempted murder. But for legal reasons, they didn't charge him with that. So when the guilty verdict came back, the judge had already admonished the audience to be quiet and to make no show of emotion. But there was plenty of emotion until the judge slammed his gavel down and quieted the room. But people were so happy and so relieved, I broke into tears, sobbing where I sat. And the judge set the date for giving him the sentence. And that would be the next day when anyone who had anything to say about how they had been affected by this crime, including me, would be able to talk to the court and to him and let him know the harm he had done. And so that was very important for me to get to sit there in the courtroom again, this time being victorious. This time I had the power. This time he sat with no power, knowing his fate would be to be in prison.
Remember the last time Refugio was convicted of rape in Mexico. While we don't know what he was initially sentenced to, he ultimately only served 5 years. So while the guilty verdict was a huge relief, there was still real anxiety around what kind of prison term Refugio would be sentenced to.
I had seen other crimes that seemed as bad, murder for one, in Brewster County, and the man had gotten 25 years. I was astonished when he was given 75 years in prison for this.
Afterwards, Jason, Billy Pat, Trish, and other authorities involved in the case went to dinner. It was a moment of sunshine after so much darkness.
All the law enforcement, the sheriff, Constable McKinney, and I, the prosecuting attorney, we went to dinner after that. I have a picture that I just love where we're all sitting there smiling, and it's the most relaxed I had felt in months.
Now the trial was over, and Refugio had been sentenced to a lengthy prison term. But the lingering effects of this story and the unresolved questions of the case, like who exactly did kidnap Refugio, continued to reverberate in the lives of Jason and those around her.
The trial was over. The event was over. All of the excitement and hoopla, reporters, everything was over. Now I had to decide what I was going to do. I was so tired, basically. I just remember being horribly exhausted. By this time, my therapist had prescribed some medication for my anxiety. And I just remember getting Nora to school, coming home, and suddenly it was time to go pick him up.
For Noah, even at a young age, he sensed a foundational change in his mother.
She was never the same again, ever.
Well, back then, the most immediate thing was she was really jumpy and panicky, like all the time, like scared. And that would scare me because as a kid, you know, if I see adults getting scared, then I should probably be scared is what I'm thinking, you know.
Noah draws a line between the last time he saw his mother prior to this event and what had changed after. In some difficult-to-define way, in Noah's perception, Jason was forever different.
It was just weird. It was kind of like that movie Invasion of the Body Snatchers. It's the same person on the outside, but they're totally different from the last time you saw them or interacted with them.
The resolution of the trial did help, though.
She'd always say, "I'm sorry, Noah, I'm sorry. Once this trial gets over, everything will be better. Once we get through this damn trial, everything will be better." And so that trial was a building point, a goal point, if you will. And she was more relieved when it was over. She was more a little less stressed out once the trial had concluded.
There was, of course, a direct impact on Noah himself.
You know, I think it affected me not so much just the event, like, oh my God, this happened. It would have affected me. The main thing was thinking, what if he had killed her and I didn't have a mother to grow up with?
Life went on. Jason went back to school and got a teaching degree. She moved to El Paso. She graduated with honors. Noah later went to college in California. Teaching wasn't easy, but Jason eventually found a school in North Texas she really enjoyed teaching at. Then, Trey came back into her life when Jason returned to Brewster County. She had enrolled in the university there to get an additional degree, a master's degree in counseling. Having overcome such trauma herself, Jason was ready to use what she had learned to help others. It may have seemed like Jason and Trey were going on different tracks, but they were always deeply connected, in more ways than Jason could have possibly known.
I was just happy to be in Brewster County, happy to be in Alpine. And I wondered who was at the ranch now. Was it Trey's sister or his father? I had no idea who was at the ranch, and I decided to go out and take a look and see. I drove out to the ranch, and as I was walking to the front door of the house, a woman came walking across the yard asking if she could help me. And I knew she thought that I was a customer. And I said, "No, I wanted to visit the ranch and see who's here, who's running the ranch." And she said, "Oh, Trey is here." And I said, and the last I had heard from him, he had gotten married. So I said, "Oh, well, perhaps I should call. I don't want to disturb him and his wife." And she said, "Oh, no, that he's been divorced for several years. It's just Trey. And he's inside, I think, taking a nap on the couch. So go on in." And I did. And sure enough, it was Trey. It was a little more than a nap. He'd had too much to drink, evidently. And so I woke him up. And I'll never forget the way he jumped up off the couch and grabbed me and just said, "Jason, I can't believe you're here." And it was quite a moment for both of us. Actually, he had tears in his eyes and he said, "Well, enough of this. Let's go make a pot of coffee and catch up." And so we did, and we drank some coffee and decided to take a ride over to the east side of the ranch, which is a beautiful part of the ranch. It's right on the banks of Ash Creek, and where we had always enjoyed being picnicking. Big cottonwood trees lined the banks of the creek, and so we drove over there and tried to catch up on the previous 11 years. He had sad news, of course. There had been so many tragedies in his family. He had gotten married and said it was a huge mistake. They were married for 2 years and had a son, but his son had been killed in an accident on his little bicycle. He was hit by a car. And his sister had been murdered by her soon-to-be ex-husband. And his brother Mark had died while he was living in East Texas. So it had been quite a hard time for Trey. And of course he knew what had happened to me, but he wanted to hear it from me, and we talked about that a little bit. It was a pretty sad moment to recount everything that had happened in his life and in my life.
And that's when Jason, in a manner of speaking, asked Trey about who kidnapped Refugio, and Trey, in a manner of speaking, gave her his answer.
When I asked him, I said, you know, I don't know how, who brought this man back to Texas. All I know is that somebody did, evidently three men did. And I would like to know, I'd like to find out. But I don't know. And at this point, Trey just looked away. He looked off toward Cathedral Mountain and didn't say anything for a few moments, and then turned to me and said, well, it just doesn't matter now.
Trey, the man who clearly held love for Jason in his heart even during the years when they were apart. Trey, the person Jason had previously made a point not to tell about this crime for fear he might do something rash. Trey, who said it just doesn't matter now. Yeah, Trey. And with that, Trey and Jason moved forward.
And he said, what do you mean you got a motel room? And I said, well, I'm staying in town. I wanted to register for school. And he said, that's nonsense. You're not staying in some motel room. You're going to stay here on the ranch. He said, you'll need a phone and you need an address. You'll be applying to all these different districts. And there's no point in you staying in a motel. And of course, you know, I'm smiling and he's smiling. And so he got the message and said, no strings attached. You know, there's a guest room. You're welcome to stay here. Let's go get your stuff out of the motel. And so that's what we did. But Trey had a drinking problem. And before I committed to coming back to the ranch, I said, Trey, you know, I can't watch you drink yourself into an early grave. And he said, oh, is that the reason you won't come back? And I said, yes. And he said, then I'll quit drinking. I'll quit today. And I said, are you sure? Can you do that? And he said, I can do it and I will do it. And he did. At the time, I had no idea how dangerous it was for a true alcoholic to just quit on a dime. He was sick for about 3 weeks after I moved to the ranch, and I took care of him and helped him through it. It was quite a difficult thing to do, but to his credit, he never took another drink. And life was more and more perfect. Here I was back in Brewster County. Here I was back on the ranch with Trey. Here I was working on the ranch.
Jason's life had taken a positive turn and seemed to only keep going that direction.
All of that had finally come to bring me to a wonderful part of my life. One day, Trey and I had gone into town to buy groceries and get a few things. And on the way home, he seemed unsettled and nervous. And finally, he said, just pull over, just stop. Stop right here. And so I did. And we were stopped right in front of Cathedral Mountain. And he started fumbling around and pulled a ring out of his pocket and said, Jason, will you please marry me? Finally, will you marry me? You'll just make me the happiest man in the world. And handed me a ring that had been his mother's. And of course, we were both crying again. Trey and I did a lot of crying because our feelings were so deep for each other, so that no matter what was going on, good or bad, it touched us deeply. And I said yes. He really breathed a sigh of relief when that was all said and done. And being Trey, I think after a few minutes, he said, okay, let's go. I need to go check on the cows.
It seemed like Jason's happy ending.
The next 14 years were the happiest years of my life. With Trey no longer drinking, we built the ranch back up. The business started booming. We had cattle again, and Trey was able to do what he loved best, which was to take care of the cattle. And I took care of, well, everything else on the ranch, the rock shop, and just giving tourists guided tours through what we had built for them. And it was a wonderful time.
But it couldn't last forever.
We found out that he was sick. He had cirrhosis. He had suffered a hernia and went in for surgery. And the surgeon came out and showed me a picture of his liver. And of course, I didn't know what it was. It was looked like this shriveled up, completely black walnut, really. And I said, what in the world is that? And she said, that's Trey's liver. He has stage 4 cirrhosis. Well, I didn't know anything about cirrhosis, but I did know the term stage 4, which meant really bad. There's not really anything they can do for you. And so, although the surgery had been planned to just be a quick day surgery and home, 3 hours into the surgery, I realized something else was going on. And sure enough, that's what it was. And so Trey stayed in the hospital a few days after that. And I was desperate to find out anything that could be done to help him. And as it happened, there was a young nurse at the hospital who had known Trey when she was a little girl. She had gone out to the ranch to hunt for rocks, and she stopped by to see him. And I walked with her out in the hall, and she said, you know, Jason, he can have a liver transplant. And I was astounded. I said, oh my gosh, really? And she said, yes. And I said, well, you know, the thing is, we don't have any insurance. And I don't know if we could afford that. And she said, well, yes, that you can afford it because there's this new insurance program through President Obama where you can get insurance for doable rates. And she gave me all the information to check on this, to check up on what's commonly become known as Obamacare, and to check on how you go about accessing the transplant people in Dallas. And so that's what we did. Trey, of course, would have none of it. He didn't want, he knew how expensive it would be. And until we found out about the insurance that we could get, he was adamant that he wouldn't do any transplant. But he did get on this insurance, and we saw the liver specialist out of Dallas who told us that he wasn't sick enough yet to be very high on the list or even get on the list, that he would have to be a lot sicker to be able to be on the list for a transplant, which was actually good news because that meant we had more time together. It wasn't as bad as we thought. This was a disease that you could live with until you could get a transplant. That's what I initially thought, and I was filled with hope after that first visit. As it turned out, a few months later, when you have a liver problem, you have a condition known as ascites, which is fluid that builds up in your abdomen, and it has to be drained off. So we went to our family doctor on the advice of this liver specialist for him to drain off the fluid. And he insisted on a CAT scan before he would do that because he wanted to pinpoint exactly where to do that. So we went to the hospital, got a CAT scan, and went back to this doctor 2 days later. And that is when he gave us the news that, unfortunately, Trey had stage 4 cancer of the liver, of the spleen. It was everywhere.
Hey, listeners, I hope you're enjoying Borderline. Stay tuned at the end of this episode. I want to tell you about a different true crime miniseries we produced at Voyage Media that I think you'll also enjoy. That's at the end of the episode.
And it was a complete shock after having gone through all the other tests for the liver situation, and no one had ever mentioned cancer. And now it was also so advanced, had metastasized so far, there was nothing they could do. And like the man he had always been, Trey sat there in that office and looked fairly stoically at the doctor and said, "I don't want chemo and radiation and whatever else y'all can dream up. I just let it take its course." The doctor looked at me because I knew when he said stage 4 that there was no chance of that being done, of that helping at all. And he said, "Trey, we'll do it just the way you want. You can have it where we just let this take its course." And when we both asked how long that course might be, he said, "You know, you don't arrive with a date on your big toe as to how long you have. And there's no way I can predict. It could be 6 weeks, it could be 6 months. There's just no way to know." And so once again, I felt sad, of course, but then again, we had this time, this precious time, probably 6 weeks, maybe 6 months, that we could be together, that we could make plans, that we could finish plans. As it turned out, the next day, Trey was really sick. And told me that he just didn't feel well, that maybe he had gotten the flu or something being in these doctor's offices. And but that he'd be all right. It'd be something he could get over. And he didn't get over it. That was a Friday. And I said, "If you're not better by tomorrow, we're going to the hospital." He looked terrible. He was very, very pale. And sure enough, Saturday morning, I woke him up and he looked horrible. So I just said, "Get dressed. We're going to the hospital now." And he died that night. He did do it just like he wanted. When we first got the news of the cancer, we came back to the ranch that afternoon, and the first thing he said was, "I'm going to go check on the cows." And I said, "No, you're not." And he said, "Yes, I am. And I'm going to saddle up Goldie, his beautiful horse, and go check on the longhorns over at the creek, because there was fire all over the county. It was a very dry, dry year." And he said, "Maybe that fire jumped the creek. I don't know. I'm going to go check on the longhorns." And so he did. I watched him ride right over the hill on the way to the creek and realized as he spent the day Saturday, then dying in the hospital, that he did indeed do it just like he wanted to. He knew that would be his last ride. And I'm glad he got to do it. Trey's ashes were sprinkled there on the ranch. You know, it's kind of interesting when something ends almost the way it began. This love affair with Trey and with Brewster County started when I first found Brewster County and first went to the ranch as a wayward soul, very young woman, and was hired by his family. And then to married to Trey and to the ranch, actually, was a full circle event. And I feel very fortunate that that is the way life turned out for me.
As for Refugio,
even to this day, the man who kidnapped me, Refugio Gonzalez, Gardea Gonzalez, is still in a Texas prison. He was given 75 years. It's been almost 35 years, and he is still in prison. Actually, even though I forgave him for what he did to me and to others, as we all found out, I think he's where he belongs. And I don't think he should be out among the general population. He needs to be where he is.
Noah, like others we spoke to during this production, was brought back into the gravitational pull of Texas after having lived elsewhere.
My son is happy and healthy and has come back to Texas, lives in the southern part of Texas, right on the coast. The special prosecutor, Trish, now is in Fort Worth, Texas, and is thinking about retiring, but says she's going to give herself another 3 or 4 years before that actually happens. And she still practices law, and she and I are glad to be back in touch with each other after all these years.
Trish's relationship with Jason was clearly far more than a routine prosecutor-defendant relationship.
After the trial was over, Jan and I did correspond a few times, just tried to keep in touch, because you just feel a connection. I didn't realize how strong that connection was until about 10 years ago. In September, I started having what I would describe as an irresistible impulse to find Jan. By then, I didn't know where she was. I didn't know if she was still here. I didn't know if she had the same name. So I started trying to track her down. It took me until February to find her. And by the time I found her, her husband had just died from cancer. I did not know that the time I started having this irresistible impulse to find her, until I did find her, that he had been fighting cancer that whole time. And it was as if there was some sort of karmic pull. And when I finally did find her, she said, "This is so amazing because you helped me when I was having trouble back then, and now you're helping me again by just calling." And I actually drove out and visited her for a couple of days.
Then there's Billy Pat.
Now, Billy Pat and I have been in touch all these years, and so he calls me, or I call him, once or twice a week. He's still in good health, but he is almost 91 years old, and so I view every talk with him as precious time spent.
Billy Pat, with his decades of knowledge of crime in general, but specifically these sorts of crimes, had a takeaway on the whole story.
I think it would be really good for young women and old women, any kind of woman, to maybe see or hear this story, because maybe it would give them courage to know that person could be prosecuted and they could get time and they could pay for the rape.
This aspect of the story, justice being served in a court of law, stuck out to Trish as well.
We still don't know who, I don't know who, the people were that decided to go take justice into their own hands and bring him back across the border. It's proof to me that they were only interested in justice because they brought him back and unharmed and let the justice system deal with his punishment. If this was a group of people who had evil in their hearts and wanted retribution, they could have taken care of that by killing him or something, you know, or harming him in some way. And instead, they just brought him back and called the sheriff. And I just thought, what an interesting thing. Does that not sound like everything you've ever heard about Texas? That if you won't come back, we'll go get you and we'll bring you back and you can stand trial. But nobody tried to hurt him.
And Jason, she's still in Brewster County.
I'm happy I still live in Brewster County and don't have plans to leave at all. I did end up selling Trey's portion of the ranch he left to me, and the rest of it was gifted to his brother by his father. And so together we first sold the west side of the ranch, and then a few years later, actually this year, ended up selling the east side of the ranch. And it's a sad thing. I only live about 5 miles from where the ranch was. I'm still connected to the area. It's sad that I can't go on that property anymore, but it's not about tangible things. It's about knowing that Trey's spirit is still here with me, and I still live in what became my adopted home so many years ago when I first got here.
Ironically, the production of this podcast provided opportunities for these people, forever bonded by this experience, to reconnect.
We had a big gathering of all the friends from that era and in that time here at the house. So it was simply amazing to see everyone again. And Trish brought pictures of the trial, what she had taken after the verdict was in. We were all, we had gone out to dinner and celebrated, and she had pictures of that. And Billy Pat said something like, "Oh, look, I had hair." And so he's bald now. I feel very blessed that all of these people are still in my life in some capacity or other.
I'm Paget Brewster. This has been Borderline. Borderline is a production of Voyage Media. The show is produced by Nat Mundell, Robert Midas, Chris Goldberg, and Dan Benamore. Nick Masite, Nick Shoup, and Andres Coca edited the show. Derlis Gonzalez wrote the original music for this series. The series is based on Jason's book, Borderline, A True Story of Courage and Justice, available on Amazon. A link is in the show notes. You can help support Borderline by leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you're listening. This helps spread word about the show. And subscribe now for future episodes.
Hey, listeners, I hope you enjoyed Borderline. I want to tell you about another true crime miniseries we produced at Voyage Media that I think you'll also enjoy. It's called Dead in the Water. It's the true story of a well-to-do Australian woman who was at a point in her life when she was looking for love. She met an eccentric but charming man who had a beautiful boat, and the idea was they were going to get married and sail around the world on this boat. Unfortunately, that's not what happened. Before it was all over, she would be fighting for her life on board that boat, and she would be defrauded of over $1 million. If you enjoy Dirty John or The Tinder Swindler, we think you're really going to enjoy Dead in the Water. Narrated by Tony Dalton from Better Call Saul, you can find Dead in the Water from Voyage Media anywhere you listen to podcasts.